3, 4.
Hello, I'm Jordan,
the other Jordan.
You may remember me as Malfoy from Season 1. I am returning this season to play a monk gemstone dragonborn known as Kazeezel. This story will take you from the beginning of his training in the monastery right through to the moment he graduates. So, thank you for your time to listen to this episode, and let's get on with it.
Off the coast of the continent of Verilean, to the north, is an island. This island grew up around a volcano, which created its own landmass. There are lots of theories and legends about this island. Some are true, some are embellished. But there are still many secrets that haven't yet been discovered by those not privy to them. The land here is steep and for the most part quite harsh. But that hasn't stopped people from making it a home. Around the base of this island, there are villages and towns that cling to the side of the mountainous terrain, filled with dragonborn. There are other species who live here, but for the most part, this is the home of dragonborn on Verilean. And as the villages and towns climb the mountainside, they give way to beautiful and ancient monasteries. The reason that Dragonborn have made this island their home, or perhaps originated here, is because this place is home to dragons. It's one of the few places known on the continent where both chromatic, metallic, and gem dragons can meet in relative safety to discuss matters of import to them. Whereas in other areas, metallic and chromatic dragonborn may fight to gain control of a region. Here it is expressly forbidden. Because of that, the monastery that grew up around this mountain trains in the way of the dragon, the way of the ascendant dragon. Many call this monastery home and a place to train. One such person found themselves left at the steps of the monastery many years ago. This isn't an uncommon tradition where dragonborn parents who find themselves incapable of looking after a child, or in the case of this dragonborn, they find themselves bringing a gem dragonborn into the world. Least common of the dragonborn and considered a blessing, these children are often brought to the monastery either as orphans or as they grow to train and learn in the ways of the Ascendant Dragon. Jordan, on the steps of the monastery is a baby dragonborn swaddled in cloth. What do they look like?
So it would be kind of a shade of purple to his skin, like a reminiscent to Amethyst, saying that he does have various gems coming from him.
Swaddled in cloth and left in a basket, the only item that he was given by his parents is a necklace with a small pendant. Etched into it is his name. What does the pendant read?
Kazeezel.
Kazeezel was left by his parents at the foot of the monastery, in the hopes that he would be trained and would be found worthy of one of the dragon god's blessings. As I've already said, this isn't an uncommon occurrence. The monastery is always willing to take in orphans and raise them in the way of the Ascendant Dragon, and Kazeezel is no different. He is raised in, if not comfort, he is raised at least in a warm and caring environment, punctuated, obviously, with lots of physical training to get him prepared to join the way when he reaches the correct age. In his time growing up in the monastery, he becomes quite close with a fellow student, a red dragonborn by the name of Ayakash Yorzavar. Being a red dragonborn, he's a little bit more hot-headed, perhaps, than Kasisil is, and quite often would get him into trouble. From a young age, the two would often be sent to carry out chores together. On one such occasion, you were sent to carry a delivery into the local town at the foot of the monastery. Some blankets that the monastery weaves as part of their way of giving back to the local towns and villages. You've just completed this delivery, and on the way back, Ayakash is pestering Kasisil. Come on, if we go through this way, we can nip through the market. Maybe, you know, pick up a couple of apples on the way back. And you can... This is something he's sort of pestered you to before, and he doesn't mean purchase these. He wants to go through the market, pick these up, sort of steal them. You know that an apple, in the grand scheme of things, doesn't cost much, but... Is this something that Kasisil would go along with, or something that he sort of tries to prevent Ayakash from doing?
He would really try and prevent this. He isn't one to willfully break any rules, whether they be his own or whether they be of the laws of a land or anything like that. He is very strict on himself that way. He believes that if he follows these rules, then it can bring some good. Him being quite different to everyone else, he doesn't want to draw any more attention than he needs to, in the sense of being seen in a bad light.
Mm-hmm.
And so even something as minor as an apple, being so different, it would be so easy to draw attention to himself. Yeah. So yes, he would be fighting against this.
Fair enough. Why don't you roll me a persuasion check and tell me what you would try and say to Ayakash to prevent him from doing this on the way back?
So
about 12. Okay, I'll roll for him as well to give him a wisdom check. Right, unfortunately, he did roll quite high, so...
Yeah.
What is it what are you trying to say to Ayakash to prevent him from doing this?
Look, we can't do this. No, just... Come on, we've got our stuff that we need. Just, let's get it back home, you know? We don't need to grab anything.
Ayakash rolls his eyes and says nothing. As you begin walking back, he falls a step behind you, and 1 minute he's there, and the next, you just, as you turn around, you just catch the flash of his tail as he disappears down an alleyway. You know this would head him over towards the market. Would you follow him, or would you just head back to the monastery with him?
After a long sigh, he'd roll his eyes and go in looking for him, trying to drag him out of trouble.
Well, you know the way, like, you know which way he's going, yeah. So as you nip down the alleyway, again, you just spot his tail as he turns a corner, you follow him down, then again as he turns another corner, until finally you're on the main thoroughfare where all the market stalls are situated. You can spot him ahead of you through the crowd, and as you're getting closer to him, you can see him getting closer and closer to one of the market stalls, where they have various fruits.
Yeah.
One of the items is a big barrel full of apples. Ooh. Okay, so he rolled quite low on his sleight of hand. Let's just see how good the shopkeeper is. Oh, shopkeeper's worse. So you see Ayakash watching the shopkeeper until his attention is somewhere else. And as soon as his back is turned, he steps forward and he attempts to, you know, very stealthily pick an apple out of the barrel. But unfortunately, at the same time, somebody knocks into him and he knocks into the barrel, knocking several apples over. The market stall holder, a copper dragonborn, turns round, and he doesn't cry out in anger. You see him sort of like helping Ayakash up and starts picking the apples up. And as you get up to Ayakash, you can spot him as he's looking to help load all the apples back into the barrel. You see him slip one or two into the robes of his attire.
Would I be, well, seeing what he's doing, I'd go right up to him and as he goes to try and pocket an apple, I'll grab him, grab his wrist, and shake my head.
Okay, we'll do a... I'll do a sleight of hand check, and you can just do either... Well, just sleight of hand check. Both of us do sleight of hand check, see if you can catch him before he slips it into his robes.
That's only a 10.
Oh, I rolled an 11, so... he just gets... Well. I mean, I'm not been rolling particularly well either. He just gets the apple into one of the inner folds of his robes as you catch his wrist, so he sort of plays it off like you're helping him up. And he winks at you and runs off down the road as the copper dragonborn finishes loading the rest of his apples back into his barrel. You chase after Ayakash, and the two of you head back to the monastery. As you approach, stood at the front gate of the monastery, sweeping some of the debris from the road, is your master, your teacher, Alfun Kerhazar. He's a silver dragonborn. Quite old, stooped in his older age, and he smiles warmly as the both of you return. Did the delivery go well?
Yeah, we've got everything here. Nothing more than we need, and I just take a glance at Ayakash.
Alfun cocks his head. Roll me a deception check. He's going to roll insight. Ooh.
So that is an 18.
Oh, I rolled a 17. He cocks his head. He thinks that's a very weird way of wording things, but he just shrugs. It's like, well, I'll see you both at dinner then. And he sort of like motions for the two of you to head past him back into the monastery. Ayakash laughs when you get inside. It's your veil, your very poor attempt at deception, pulls out one of the apples, throws it to you, and then runs off into the monastery. We fast forward a few years. In Dragonborn years, you're probably the equivalent of a young teenager at this point, and you're undergoing a sparring session. This is part of your regular training at this point. You would spar most days at least, practicing your forms and carrying out pair work with another student. Usually this would be with Ayakash as well, as you were both a similar age, size. It's much easier for you two to trade together. So right now you're just doing a standard sparring session. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a couple of rules just to do a standard, essentially simulating a fight, except we're just going to do a roll, like almost like a three grapple checks. So just you roll one of your unarmed strikes, and I'll just do the same, see who wins out of the three of them.
Okay.
It's a 13.
That is 9.
Cool. So as you're sort of, you know, you're moving back and forth into each other, stepping away, trying to find a better position, you step forward to strike at Ayakash's head. He dips slightly, bringing a hand up into your elbow and knocking it to the side, following up with a flat palm to the chest, pushing you back a step.
Yeah.
So roll again for the second one.
A 5.
I rolled a 4, so...
Oh, yay!
Yeah, worked out. So he goes to follow up from this shove, but you take your momentum stepping back, pivot on your heel, and as he steps forward, you reach out, grab a hold of his leading hand, and twist, pulling him to the side, and you attempt to throw him off balance. So we'll go for the third and final one.
17.
9. You get yourself planted, you've got a hold of his front arm, you get a second hand planted on his shoulder, and you twist and turn, dropping your hips down and throw him down to the ground, pinning him. And you raise a hand above his head, ready to strike, and he puts his two hands up, grins, and says, "Yield." You step up, helping him to his feet. You take a step apart from one another, bow slightly, and turn to Alfun, who has been watching you spar. He nods, looks at you, and says, "Well done, Kazisal. That was good movement, using your opponent's weight and momentum against him. Ayakash, patience in combat. You had the advantage, but pressed too hard, and Kazisal punished you for it." You look sidelong at Ayakash next to you and see him rolling his eyes. "But you've both done well today. I will speak to you later, as you're both soon coming to the age where you will be carrying out the ritual. Make sure you practice your forms. And he bows to each of you. You bow in return, and he heads off into the monastery. Ayakash wanders over to a low wall, next to which is a barrel full of water. He pulls a pitcher out for himself and begins to drink, takes a deep sigh and says, I can't wait to finish this ritual. Leave this place, go adventuring. What about you, Kasista? What will you be doing?
It'll be nice to see the world out there, you know. But we need to be ready for it. And right now, we're not. We need to keep training until we are ready.
You've, as you're saying this, you've turned away to fill your own pitcher. As you look over, he's sort of mocking, mimicking you, moving his mouth as you're speaking, rolling his eyes. Come on, Kasista. We're nearly old enough now. What more is there to learn here in these dusty halls? It's common knowledge in the monastery that some people, yeah, even when they complete the ritual, they will stay, they will continue their training here, and they will attempt to learn more of the way through repetitive training and meditation here within the monastery's walls. It's not uncommon, actually it is fairly common, that those, once they've completed the ritual, will go and spend a time outside the monastery, traveling, learning, and improving their own abilities before returning to the monastery, using their learned experiences to help continue them on the path of the way of the Ascendant Dragon. Ayakash, you get the impression he's just impatient to get beyond these walls. He's feeling quite constricted here. How has Kasista found growing up in the monastery, never travelling further than the edges of the island itself?
He himself will be very eager to get out. Like I say, he's been there his entire life from the moment he was pretty much born and handed off. So he hasn't seen much else other than the lands around the monastery. So he's yearning for something more than what he's been living so far. But he understands that what he's doing is important.
Mm-hmm.
Not just to the others, but to him as well, finding his purpose, so to speak. But he understands where Ayakash is coming from. He wants to get out there. He wants to see more of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, once you've sort of finished your break, sort of recovery from the sparring, you each head your separate ways. You have your own chores and tasks to be getting on with in the afternoon. And later in the day, as he promised, Alfun comes and finds you separately. He takes you out onto one of the gardens in the monastery, a walled garden which sits on the steep incline of the mountainous ranges of the island. He takes you and sits by the edge of one of these walled gardens and overlooking the steep incline side of the mountain, looking down upon the other parts of the monastery and the villages and towns below. You know that the way the monastery is built, the higher up the mountain you go, the higher ranks you need to be within the way of the Ascendant Dragon.
Yeah.
You've only ever seen the lowest regions, the sort of training areas for those who haven't quite made it into the way yet. The places where most of the menial work is carried out, the weaving, the knitting, the sort of all the things that keep the monastery running and allow them to trade with the local villages. Even you haven't been much higher than this, except for delivering the occasional message. But as you sit, you realise even here, the lowest point of the monastery, you still sit above most of the island. And it is a fantastic view. Even from here, you can just about make out the coastline of the island, and you realise, well, you start to realise how small your world has been up to this point, but also how big it is as well. It is a beautiful place, as you sit, as the sun is just setting down in the horizon. It flashes over the water. You can just about make out on the edge of the island itself. Althun rests with his eyes closed and his head pointed up into the sky, feeling the breeze wash over him. And you sit for a while in quiet meditation, something you're quite used to. You know, this is, part of your training has been to meditate, to become one with yourself and the world around you, and you can quite happily sit here and just take in this environment for a time. Eventually, Althun opens his eyes and he looks at you and smiles gently. A few more years and you'll be ready to take the ritual. I know you are aware of the technical aspects, but what you may not be aware is that not everyone is capable of passing the ritual. Some fail and are capable of retaking it, though some never do. I think you will be fine, Kazisa. And he looks off towards the sunset. I worry for Ayakash, though. His impatience may get the better of him. If he does not succeed and is not allowed to progress, I fear that he may leave us of his own means.
This episode is brought to you by the Big Red Button Podcast.
Do you know what you'd do in a nuclear apocalypse?
Because we sure as quack don't.
See how our choices get us into trouble and back out again in this actual play podcast.
Big Red Button is for lovers of the Fallout franchise, choose your own adventures, and tabletop role-playing games rolled into one big audio drama.
Our band of stragglers is unraveling a mystery in the wasteland, and we're at the mercy of the roll of the dice.
So grab your Geiger counters, take your rat away, and subscribe to our new show, The Big Red Button.
I myself find myself wanting to get out there. I'm eager to get out there myself. So I understand where he's coming from. We've been here pretty much all our lives. But I understand this is bigger than this path we're on. It's bigger than what we are.
Arthur nods slowly. Yes, as we tell all of our students, you are free to leave when you wish, but to do so before the ritual means you do not receive the backing of the monastery. Ayakash knows this, and I fear he may do something rash. He looks at you and he smiles. I know you, Kazisa, understand the importance of the ritual and our teachings. I know you take it seriously and have the patience to wait. I do not fear what should happen if you were to fail, though I have every confidence you will pass. I do worry for Ayakash, though. And he looks looks off to the sunset again. And then says, but, and he slaps his hands against his leg. Thoughts for another time, I think. Come, I will run you through some of the forms for the ritual. And he stands with you, and the two of you stand in the garden, practicing the motions and the forms of the kata that you'll have to perform during the ritual. And as the sun sets, the two of you stand, you mimicking his movements to the best of your ability and memorizing them as best you can. We flash forward another couple of years. It is the morning gain entry to the actual way, as it were. Up until now, you again have been considered, you know, monks in training. You're not a full-fledged monk yet, but today is the day that you and Ayakash undergo the ritual which will allow you to become fully-fledged monks. As you step outside, having broken your fast, you see Ayakash in the training ground sparring with another of the students, sort of burning off some of his restless energy. As you step outside to watch him, four kobolds sort of brush past your legs. Wyvern's Reach is one of the few places on the continent where kobolds as well as dragonborn are sort of welcomed and treated as equals.
Yeah.
They aren't necessarily hunted across the rest of Erlian, that you're aware of, at least you've not been there. But you know that for most places, kobolds are considered more of a pest than anything else. But here, they have found a like-minded people who wish to emulate and learn and train from dragons themselves. So they find this as a second home. So much like the Dragonborn and the dragons themselves, this is a place where they could be found in greater number than most places. And the four who step out past you are four that you know quite well. They are four brothers that you have trained with. Obviously, with a kobold lifespan being what it is, they only joined the monastery a couple of years ago, but you've spent some time training with them. They are called Leoninar, Rafafa, Donatella, and Milangel. Look, I wasn't going to put turtles in, but...
It's close enough.
It's close enough. They brush past you and they come out to watch Ayakash training as well. You notice a ferocity in Ayakash's movements. He's grinning as he spars with his opponent and is just overwhelming them with sheer force and energy. Leoninar turns to Rafafa and shakes his head. It's like, he's as impatient as ever. Rafafa nods slowly. Donatella's watching eagerly, leaning and squinting. Yes, but his movements are good. And Milangel, who's currently still eating some meat and bread from breakfast, looks up at you and said, today's the ritual, isn't it? You worried?
I'd be lying if I said I wasn't.
He nods.
But I think I'm finally ready. I've got it in me. I just wish he'd believe in himself more as well, you know?
As you say that, Ayakash is pummeling just like punch after punch after punch into the guard of the Dragonborn he's sparring with until it eventually breaks and he rushes forward, hooks a leg behind him and pushes him to the ground, standing over him with a fist raised before yelling out in triumph. Ayakash has always been a little bit more vocal and energetic, yeah. Even among the chromatic dragonborn of the monastery. He gets a few disapproving looks from the actual monks there to carry out training sessions as he raises his voice in victory. He looks over and sees you with the four kobold brothers and grins from ear to ear.
Gazisel, it's the day. Finally, we can get out of here.
Just keep our training in mind. Make sure you keep calm. Don't let your hastiness get ahead of you. We've been working towards this our whole lives. Just stay calm, and we will get through this.
He rolls his eyes, laughs, and turns to walk towards the water butt, rolling his shoulders. The four kobolds look up at you, shrug, and Milangel slaps you in the back of the thigh and says, good luck today! And the four of them head off to carry out their own training. It's later in the day. You've undergone your sort of morning training sessions to prepare you, sort of final bits of training and preparation, some basic sparring, going over the forms and of the kata again and getting ready for the ritual. They call it the ritual, but it is more of an exam almost.
Yeah.
You will be tasked to spar with one of the monks. You will carry out sort of what they refer. You know, in karate, we call pair work. You carry out a series of movements in a pair with one of the monks as well. And then you finish it by carrying out a series of kata, practicing or moving through the forms that you've practiced and learned over the years. Unlike a lot of other sort of monk monastery traditions, this being the way of the Ascendant Dragon, even the non-dragonborn here, as they practice and learn these kata, they unlock aspects of the dragons after which they were modeled. So that even those with no draconic blood in them can learn to channel their ki and breathe fire or rake at their enemies with hardened, as if their hands were hardened claws. So the movements are a little bit different from a lot of the other ways that can be studied. But to you, they've come naturally. You have been doing these pretty much all of your life at this point, and you have them memorized. As the time approaches, you and the four other students who will be undergoing the ritual are lined up in the courtyard in front of the testing hall. Elthun comes out and stands at the doorway to the testing hall, looks you all over, and you all approach, kneel before him, and settle down. He nods, looks at you all, and says,
as you all know, today is the day you will be undertaking the ritual. Remember what you have been taught. Remember everything you have learnt here. And you will be fine.
He nods, gives a slight bow, you all bow in return, and he motions for the first of the students to step forward. He's brought inside, and the rest of you are left in the courtyard waiting to be called forward. What would Cecil be thinking while he's waiting?
He himself would be worried for Ayakash. Because he can, even earlier in the day, seeing the way he was fighting, he sees he's not ready for the ritual, and he'll be worried as to what he will do if he's denied. Well, if he isn't able to pass, and that will be going through his mind, but at the same time, he's trying to keep his own mind calm and steady and thinking about what he has to do himself. And so inside, he's torn. He wants to do what he can to help Ayakash, but he doesn't know how he can help. And so he's trying to focus on himself as well, because he can't let a lifetime of training go to waste at this point.
Time passes. It feels like it drags on for hours when only minutes have passed. But again, the passage of time isn't something you've often been concerned about. You meditate, you think on Ayakash, you think on your own training, and you mentally prepare yourself. You do occasionally glance over and spot Ayakash fidgeting, tapping a claw against his chest, shaking his leg in irritation. And over time, the door is opened again. Althun comes out and calls forward the next student. You can tell just by the way they're being called that you're going to be next to be called through. You prepare yourself, and eventually the door opens for a second time. Althun steps out and motions for you to follow him inside. You step through a large, solid wooden door and step into a large, open chamber with vaulted ceilings held up by large, thick wooden posts. At the far end of the hall, kneeling on a raised dais, are four figures. Two are dragonborn, wearing monks of the Way of the Ascendant Dragon. One is a human, and one is an elf. And both human and the elf have what appears to be scale-like features running across their face. A gift for those who ascend far enough in the way. You're brought forward by Althun, who motions for you to kneel before the dais, and he steps up to join the others on the platform. He stands between the four of them, looks out to you and says,
Cecil, today you will undergo the ritual to determine whether or not you are ready to become a monk in the Way of the Ascendant Dragon. You have completed your training up until this point. Do you believe you are ready to take the ritual?
Cecil will take a long inhale. Yes, I believe I'm ready.
Althun nods. He takes a second and says,
The outcome of the ritual today has three possibilities. Should you be determined to have passed, you may leave through the door to your left, a fully fledged monk of the Way of the Ascendant Dragon. Should you be determined unready to progress, you may either return through the door through which you entered and continue your training to retake the ritual when you are ready, or you can leave through the door to your right. You can find a life somewhere else, whether that is on the Wyvern's Reach or on the main continent itself. But know that should you choose this, you will not have the backing or the support of the monastery. Are you prepared to proceed?
I am.
He nods. He motions to the side and stepping from the wall is another monk that you had noticed when you'd come in. He is another dragonborn. You can tell from the robes he's wearing that he is much lower ranked than those on the dais, but a monk of the Way of the Ascendant Dragon nonetheless. He steps forward. You stand up, turn to face him, aware that this is to be your sparring partner. You bow, and the two of you take a stance to begin combat. You wait. Althun looks at both of you and says, "Begin!" As Althun's voice echoes throughout the chamber, the dragonborn across from you, a brass dragonborn, launches forward to attack. So we're going to do the same thing as we did with Ayakash. We're going to do three rounds of combat, just pretty much rolling off against one another. So we'll go for the first one now.
So that is a 18.
Ooh, lovely. As he steps forward, he plants a foot, twists, and goes to jab a punch at your head. You were ready for this. As the fist comes up, you move your hand, push the fist to the side, and step in, dropping your weight, ready to launch a blow into the midsection of this dragonborn. Second roll.
So that is an 8.
As you drop your weight, you begin to throw your elbow out to connect with his midriff. The dragonborn steps back slightly, moving out of your range, and as he does, he takes his forward leg, hooks it beneath your ankle on your leading foot, and pulls, bringing you off balance, dropping you forward. Final roll.
That is a 17.
You feel your balance give out. You begin to fall forward. As you do, you grip on to the arm that you had previously brushed to the side to throw the attacker off balance. You use this to pull yourself around, twisting on your heel and bringing your knee up into his midsection. He can't react in time, and as you connect, he's driven back, steps a few paces away, lowers his guard, and bows towards you. He steps to the side, and Althun once again steps forward.
"Very well done, Kasisil. Once again, you took your attacker's momentum and turned it against him. Very well done."
He nods to the monk who was sparring with you, who steps to the side.
"Now, you'll perform Soaring Dragon."
He nods to you and settles back down onto his knees. You stand before him and the other monks on the dais, and take the beginning stance for the kata called the Soaring Dragon. This is a kata you've been practicing for years now. You know every movement, every muscle that has to be controlled for this. You turn, strike, kick. You move as if you were grappling an enemy and throwing them to the ground, guarding against unseen attacks. The final movement of this kata involves you leaping into the air and delivering a kick to the head of an unseen enemy several feet taller than you, and you land with your claws outstretched, ready to continue. And as you stand there, your muscles taut, your breath coming heavy, steam rising from your body. Althun on the dais and the other monks all nod. Althun stands and says,
"You have done well, Kasisil. Step forward."
He steps down from the dais in front of you, bows in front of you, you bow in return, and he pulls out a belt that would be tied around your robes, with the emblem of the monastery emblazoned on the front.
"I welcome you to the Way of the Ascendant Dragon."
Deep down, he is, at this point, trying so hard to keep his emotions in check. He's got a smile growing as he's being told he's passed and being given the belt. And he takes a moment to really take it in and try and suppress what he's feeling right now.
Mm-hmm. Althun sees this, smiles, and says, "It's okay. You're allowed to be excited."
I don't know what to say. I believed I would pass. I believed in myself. But it's actually happened. And thank you for all the training for over the years and believing in me and teaching me to believe in myself too.
He nods. The smile on his face disappears. And he says, "Now that you are a member of the Way, I must tell you there is another step. The reason we call this the ritual as opposed to a test is because of the next step. Follow me." And he leads you through the door that was to the left when you entered, as he said you would leave through that door once you had passed. You step through another set of heavy laden doors into a darker room this time, lit only by candles set about the room. The walls here appear to be stone, and you realise that the building you entered is actually butted up against the stone of the mountain itself. And as you've entered through this doorway, you realise you're now within the walls of the mountain. The wall in here is bare stone, which has been decorated. You step into a square room. On the wall to your left is a fresco featuring Tiamat in all her chaotic glory, her five chromatic heads rearing back and roaring their defiance to the world. The wall to the right is marked with a fresco of Bahamut, his platinum scales gleaming with their own light as they throw back the brilliance of the candles a thousand times over. And between the two of them on the wall directly in front of you is a curled and sleeping ruby dragon. You know this to be Sardior. His body is cracked and fractured, even as it throws back brilliant red light from the candles. Althun walks you to the centre of the room, gestures to the frescoes on the wall, and says,
"Unknown to most, our Way of the Ascendant Dragon serves the three dragon gods. Tiamat,"
and he bows towards the fresco,
"Bahamut,"
he bows towards Bahamut,
"and Sardior,"
and he bows towards Sardior.
"The ritual is the final step of joining the Way. Here you will determine whether you have been chosen by one of the gods to carry out their work in the world. Kneel here with me in the room."
And he kneels down in the middle of the room.
"There are no words or forms to this one. Only meditation."
You see him settle into a meditative posture. And you quickly do the same.
Yeah.
In this room, with the smoke of the candles drifting past you, you don't know how much time passes. But you do begin to feel something. Rising tension, like a string pulled too tight. You can almost feel it thrumming in the air. It starts to grate on you, builds like a pain behind your eyes, until you finally hear a sound like stone cracking, and you're blinded by pain that erupts in front of your eyes. Bright red light streams into your vision, and you're knocked full flat onto your back. Althun jumps to his feet and pulls you up. He's looking at you in shock and, frankly, confusion.
Kazisil, are you okay?
You're in a lot of pain, but physically you feel okay.
He'd be gritting his teeth from a pain. He'd bring his hand to where the majority of the pain was coming from, on his hair.
Well, as you bring your hand up, you go to rub your between your eyes, essentially. But as your hand comes up, you feel it sort of tink off something about an inch from your head. You sort of move your head, like looking around and straining your eyes to see. And Althun, like, stops you.
Whoa, hold.
He walks over to one of the areas where the candles are set, and he pulls up a metal platter that some of the candles are resting on, wipes them off, sets them on the floor next to them, and holds this plate up to you on the so that you can see your reflection on the underside. And you can now see floating just between where your horns meet, just before in front of your forehead, is a cracked, splintered ruby gemstone floating just above your head. And as you turn your head to look this way and that, it moves with your body as if hanging just on a string in front of your head. Althun allows you to look for a second, sets the plate down and says,
I'm going to be honest, this one's new. I've not seen this before. Come, sit.
He sets you down on sort of a little bench to the side of the room.
You may have heard rumors about those chosen by the gods.
And you would have done. In the history of the sort of monastery, there have been rumors of champions of the various dragon gods, although you've only ever heard of those chosen by Tiamat or Bahamut. Those gifted by Tiamat would be granted chromatic scales on different parts of their body in various colors, and those gifted by Bahamut might be given platinum scales running across their face. You've never heard of anyone being chosen by Sardior. The reason for this being that he's considered the sleeping god or the sleeping dragon. You're aware of the history, or very vaguely of the history, yeah. And that's originally there was Tiamat and Bahamut, and together they create Sardior. And then since that creation, Sardior has been sleeping. And the various histories of the world have unfolded, Tiamat being banished and Bahamut fighting for her freedom. But there aren't a lot of specifics, this being very ancient history and one closely guarded by the dragons themselves. You would be aware that to be chosen by Sardior is unheard of. He is a sleeping god. He has no real ability to affect the world in any way. You're aware that those dragonborn and those from the Way of the Ascendant Dragon who do draw on his power are essentially pulling on a resource. They aren't being gifted like a paladin or a cleric would. This is a latent ability that is stored somewhere in the world that they're able to draw on and use. To have him reach out and choose a champion is unheard of. Althun sort of explains a little bit of this as well.
I've been doing this for quite some time, and I've never seen Sardior choose a champion. I've never seen anyone react to Sardior or have Sardior react in any way. I'm sure you have a lot of questions, and frankly, so do I. Wait here one moment.
He heads back out the door that you came in through. You hear an exchange of words outside. Voices raise slightly in confusion.
Meanwhile, this is happening. Kaziza will pick up the plate again and staring into the reflection at the ruby that's above his head. Mm-hmm. In almost trance-like state. But he's still hearing the noise that's going on outside.
As you stare at it, you can see there's ever so slight amount of movement to it. It's not fixed rigid to your head. There's a very slight sort of bob and weave to it. And if you were to touch it as well, there is a bit of move, like a give there, almost like it's held in place by elastic. But eventually the sound outside dies back down, and Althun shuffles back into the room.
I've told them to continue the ritual without me. Come. We have someone we must speak to.
And he leads you further through another doorway to in one of the walls further up. You travel upward through the actual walls of the mountain itself for a short distance before you come out at a level above where you travel through the monastery proper again. At this time of the day, most people are out either training or carrying out their chores. So you do not pass many people, but those you do pass stop to stare at you. This isn't, you've seen those who have ascended through the Way of the Ascendant Dragon. They gain abilities or gifted things by dragons themselves. You've seen those who have odd colorations to their scales, or in the case of non-dragonborn races, those who've been granted scales where they had none before. But you've never seen anyone gifted something like this. It draws attention. Althun ushers you along, trying to prevent as many people as possible from seeing you, and you travel further and further up the mountain, further than you'd ever even considered the monastery even went. You stand before a great metal door on which are engraved the three god dragons, Bahamut on one side, Tiamat on the other, and between the two of them, Sardior, curled in a sleeping posture. Althun steps forward, and there are two dragonborn monks and two kobold monks standing guard before the door. As they see Althun, he steps forward and bows and says,
"We must speak with the council."
The two monks nod, push open the doors, and they swing inward on silent hinges. Althun beckons for you to follow him, and you step back into the mountain proper, heading down carved stone hallways lit by torches in their braziers. You head further in until you reach another set of metal doors, again guarded by two dragonborn and two kobold. As they see Althun approaching, they nod and push open the doors. One of the kobolds heads off down a side passageway. You're brought inside to a large circular room. As you look around, you realize that this room isn't worked stone. It appears to have been cut from the rock itself with great claws. On the far side of the room is a semicircular table, which appears to have been broken into three sections. Behind each of these three sections rest five great stone chairs. Both the chairs and the table appear to have been cut from the rock of the room as well. On the far wall behind the table stands a great door. You realise that this door is some 30 feet tall and 20 feet wide. It currently stands shut. The room is lit by guttering torches, causing shadows to leap and dance across the walls. You stand for some time with Althun next to you waiting patiently. The only sound, the sputtering of the torches. Eventually, the doors on the opposite wall click, the sound reverberating around the room, and they swing open on silent hinges. Filing into the room are a line of people. They walk to the seats around the table, each apparently picking one very deliberately, as there are gaps and spaces left between them. Once all of the members of this group have filed in, they sit. You look along the table, taking each of these people in. On the far left, you see a very old, brittle-looking human. Half their face is burned with acid scarring. The eye on that side is cloudy white, and they are missing most of the hair on their head. They wear royal blue robes, and even though they look like the wind could knock them over, they carry themselves with grace and majesty of a powerful ruler. They lean heavily on a scepter composed of gold and sapphires, and as they sit looking at you, you find yourself on the end of an exhausted but determined-looking gaze. Two seats over from them sits an old withered elf, wearing finely tailored clothes which appear to be sodden and damp. He perches at the edge of his seat, and with nails like fish hooks he drums his fingers on the table before him, sending ripples up his pulpy, swollen flesh. While they're waiting to begin, you see him pull a small bird from his cloak, and crunches it down in two slow bites. His lips would stop the blood from flowing between his predator teeth had they not long rotted away. Directly next to him is a large and muscular Goliath, resting at ease in his chair. He wears plate armour tinged with red ochre, and even seated, he is at least a head taller than all others around the table and twice as broad. His fiery red hair is tinged with grey at the temples, and a bright white scar runs diagonally across one eye down to his strong jawline. They take in everything in the room and appear ready to react at the slightest provocation. Two seats down sits a pale grey drow with flowing sea foam coloured hair. They sit primly, politely in their chair. Their robes shimmer iridescent in the light, a wash of blues giving way to greens and purples and back again. A genuine smile plays at the corner of their mouth, reaching their light green eyes with a playful glint, though the long, fine points of their fingernails warn visitors to be mindful of decorum. Three seats down sits a tall elf dressed in midnight blue silk, a large, deep, round sapphire hanging on a white gold chain around his neck. His hair is fair and his skin is smooth, but his eyes look cold and older than the mountains. He sits at the table, one hand resting on its edge, palm upward, where a small stone pebble floats and rotates gently. Two seats down again sits a beautiful half-elf, blithe and becoming, snowfall tresses dusting the shoulders of a silken gown, which continues to flow down their back. Her youthful blush belies the weight of her ancient gaze as she watches you intently. She sits with a regal poise in her seat, hands resting in her lap. Next to them, an ancient-looking dwarf with long white hair and a braided beard which falls to their feet. Their skin is a sun-kissed bronze akin to old leather, with wrinkles and creases indicating a long and interesting life. Their eyes, however, are bright and belay an intelligence which terrifies you as they appear to be looking into your very mind. And finally, two seats down, sits a 4-foot-tall halfling woman, with long, wiry silver hair, wearing large swathes of fabric in various shades of brown and orange. Ballooning sleeves hang down past their hands. They have a mischievous grin on their face, and their eyes flash as they take you in. Give me a wisdom saving throw, please.
18.
Okay. You feel... What would you feel? As you look out on the 8 people assembled, you have a flash in your vision, and where each of these humanoids is now sat, you instead see them for what they really are. Dragons. Ancient and powerful dragons. You look along the table, and superimposed on the images of the people you see them for what they are. A blue, black, and red dragon sit on the left-hand side of the table, their forms seeming to fill the room. In the centre, a moonstone dragon sits next to a sapphire, their brilliance casting the light from the torches back to the wall and shimmering. And on the right, a silver, gold, and copper dragon, their metallic scales glistening in the torchlight. This vision of the dragons in their true form fades, and you're left looking at the various humanoids once again. To one side, from what the side that you knew, were sat the metallic dragonborns. The one that you recognised to have been the silver dragon looks to Althun next to you and says, "I see he carries the mark of Sardior. This is unusual." Althun nods and says, "Yes, I recognised as much and believed it was something the council should know about." You see, each of the dragons in their humanoid forms look to one another. There are a few eyebrows raised before the silver dragon turns again and says, "Yes, most unusual." They turn to you. "Monk, what is your name?"
"I am Kazizel."
"Kazizel. Chosen of Sardior. There is much you should know, but little that we can explain. But most importantly, you should know our history." Each of the dragons look to one another in turn. The silver dragon stands, followed by the rest. They all come to their feet, standing tall and proud. And beginning with the silver dragon, they begin to recite.
"Breathe, dragons, sing of the first world, forged out of chaos and painted with beauty. Sing of Bahamut, the platinum, moulding the shape of the mountains and rivers. Sing, too, of chromatic Tiamat, painting all over the infinite canvas. Partnered, they woke in darkness. Partnered, they labored in acts of creation."
"Breathe, dragons, sing then of Sardior, ruby-red jewel they made in their likeness. Sardior, firstborn of dragonkind, labored alongside Bahamut and Tiamat, shaping the dragons they crafted, dragons metallic and dragons chromatic. Breathe, dragons, draw in the life gift breathed into you at the dawn of creation."
"Breathe, dragons, sing of the outsiders, war-bringer gods with their mortal adherents. Teeming, they came to the first world, seeking a home for their legions of followers. Mighty in magic and numbers, conquering deities seize their victory. fallen was noble Bahamut. Sardaur hid in the heart of creation.
Breathe, dragons. Sing now of Tiamat, raging in battle with no hope of victory. She would not yield or surrender, fighting as death reached its cold claws around her. Its cold claws toward her. Warbringers seized her and bound her, snatched her from death, entombed in torment. Entombed her in torment. Sealed in the darkness forever, captive to gods laying claim to creation.
Breathe, dragons, sing of the conquest, seeding the world with their legions of followers, each to their own habitation. Elves in their forests and dwarves in their mountains, orcs in their caverns and canyons, goblins in badlands and halflings in green elves, lizard folk lurking in marshes, humans throughout every part of creation.
Breathe, dragons. Sing of Bahamut, maker of peace with the outsider deities, welcomed to Mountain Celestial, worshipped by some as the Platinum Paladin. Sing of his journeys of seeking, striving to understand gods and their children, longing for Tiamat's freedom, grieving her loss from the face of creation.
Breathe, dragons, sing of her freedom, Tiamat loose from her prison of torment. Tell how she rallied her children, dragons chromatic, a spectrum of mayhem. Sing of her fury, her vengeance, lightning and venom, ice fire and corrosion. Five-headed, monstrous and mighty, rampaging on a campaign of destruction.
Breathe, dragons. Sing of the first world, scattered in infinite seedling realities. Sing of Bahamut and Tiamat, watching sundering, mourning their labor. Sing too of Sardaur asunder, consciousness scattered in minuscule fragments. Breathe, dragon. You are inheritors, ruling the wreck of the first world's destruction.
Each of the dragons in turn read a verse, and when it was finished, they sit in silence, the echoes of their voice ringing throughout the chamber. Again, the silver dragon looks to you and says, "According to the history of the dragons, Bahamut and Tiamat created the first world along with Sardaur. Then came the meddling races, the lesser of those who inhabit this world and all those like it. The war sundered this first world, and with it Sardaur, who had made himself a part of it." She steps out from behind the table and walks towards you. "His consciousness was lost and fragmented and broken, and spread across all the worlds in creation." She reaches forward and taps a lacquered fingernail against the ruby floating before your head. "Fragments like this one." She taps a foot on the floor and a light emanates into the centre of this cavern, and what was previously a stone floor flashes, becomes like obsidian glass, and beneath which sits a great ruby. almost the size of the room itself, some 20 or 30 feet across. In every world in creation, there are pieces of Sardior. Some are large, she gestures to the one in the floor, and some are not, and she gestures to the one floating before your head. It is one of the tasks of the Way of the Ascendant Dragon to locate and retrieve as many of these fragments as possible, so that one day all of the pieces of Sardior can be reunited and he can be reborn and reawoken. She looks you dead in the eye. Would you accept this task as chosen of Sardior?
He would look to the Flossie and the giant Ruby, and then he'd try to look to the one between his eyes, not being able to see it.
Going cross-eyed.
He'd smile a little and nod. I accept.
The silver dragon in front of you nods. The rest around the table also nod. You feel a warmth emanating from the ruby in front of your head, and almost a slight tugging towards the larger ruby in the floor. The silver dragonborn taps their foot again, and the floor flashes back into the solid rock you saw before. There are not many fragments of Sardior within the world. We do not expect you to be returning with sackfuls of them. These are rare and powerful objects. Some have been found and used by other races. Some have already been retrieved and brought back here for protection. Should you find them, you should try and retrieve them. But we are not expecting immediate results. But I expect Sardior has chosen you for a reason. While you're within the monastery, you may call upon the council and we will answer any questions we can. But for now, I believe you need to rest. The ritual can be taxing, and I'm sure you have much to think on. The silver dragon nods their head. The remainders around the table stand up and they begin to file out of the room. Althun, next to you, you see visibly relax and let out a breath he appeared to have been holding. And once the last of the dragons have left and the doors have closed, he shakes slightly and says, I'm always left in awe of their power. It is something to behold. But come, we have an answer at least, and you have a task. But for tonight, we will celebrate. And I'll soon lead you back out and back further down the monastery to a hall which has been prepared to celebrate those who've completed the ritual. It's not long after you return that you realise that one person hasn't arrived yet. Ayakash has not come through the ritual chamber. When you return with Althun, he is approached by one of the other monks and they exchange several words, and you can see him looking visibly upset. He approaches you and says, Ayakash was not deemed ready. He did not return to continue his training. He has left the monastery. He puts a hand on your shoulder. I know this will be difficult, but by our own rules, we cannot stop him. And though it is sad, we still have much to celebrate, so we will eat and drink tonight in celebration of you, and to toast Ayakash in the hopes that we may one day see him again.
I do hope I see him again. If he's still here on the island, or if he's out there. It's sad that he's chosen this path, but we are not one to direct him. It's his own.
Althun nods. The two of you continue on the rest of the night. You celebrate with the two other students who have passed the ritual this time. You take several days to get yourself ready. There isn't much to be done. Some provisions have to be gathered. You're provided with your new robes that symbolize being a member of the Way of the Ascendant Dragon. You discuss with Althun what your path should be going forward and where you should travel to. They arrange for transport off of Wyvern's Reach to deliver you on to Verlaine proper. You do not hear from Ayakash in this time, nor when you leave or arrive on Verlaine. There is no note, no message from him. But you have a task to complete. You set out on Verlaine ready to forge your own path, hoping to fulfill the task that you believe Sardior has put before you. You're travelling for several days. You make camp one evening, and just as you're set up, you settle down to sleep, and as you do so, you begin to dream. Could you give me a number between 1 and 19, please?
8.
8, was it?
Yeah.
8, cool. As you fall into a deep and restful sleep, you begin to dream. Initially, you find yourself standing in one of the courtyards at the monastery. There is training going on around you with other monks, though their movements seem to be in slow motion, but at the same time blurred beyond recognition, almost echoes of themselves following along through the motions. You step further up through the monastery and enter into the ritual room again. And as you stand before the three frescoes, you look to Tiamat. The heads seem to pull themselves free of the wall, roaring their defiance at the warped world around them. You can feel the heat and the crackle of lightning from the breath of the five heads. You look to Bahamut, and he, as his great platinum head pulls free of the wall, as golden canaries flit about the room around you, filling it with beautiful music. And then directly before you, Sardior. His fresco seems to breathe. You know that he is asleep. You do not expect much from him, but you see one eye slowly open and look directly at you. The room around you falls away, and this eye of Sardior fills your vision. Great and red and beautiful. You look down and realize that you're standing in the palm of a great ruby clawed hand. Sardior holds you within his palm. And as you stand on this ruby crystalline surface, you hear a voice in your head.
There is much to be done.
The clawed hand closes around you. Your vision goes black. And then you waken up. You just drew the Talons card. After that night's sort of restless sleep, you continue on your way, thinking on the words from the dream and what they might mean. You start to realize that the supplies and the funds that the monastery provided you are growing thin, and you must look for work to help you on your way. You come across a poster. The poster reads, "Adventurers wanted. Reports of monster attacks on the rise in the local countryside. Skilled adventurers needed to cull their numbers and find the lair. Reward on completion. Report to Knight's Valor Keep for the details." You head off towards Knight Valor, beginning your own adventure. Well, that's the last of our introduction episodes. We hope you've enjoyed meeting the cast of our new party, and we can't wait for you to join them on their adventure. With this episode though, I do have some very special shoutouts. The guests you heard earlier in the episode were reading The Elegy of the First World from Fizban's Treasury of Dragons. The ones reading that were Diana of Multiclass Theatre, Richard of the D20 Future Show, Lucas of Ballad of the Seven Dice, Dan from the Backwater Bastards, Dragon from Penance RPG, Cassie from The Lovely Craftians, Naomi from Power Word Rule, and Max from Help Action. I cannot thank these guys enough for coming along and recording those sections for me, as I think it's added something really special to this episode. I hope you agree, and I hope you go and check out all of those guys if you haven't already, because we cannot recommend them enough. They are lovely friends to this show. But other than that, that's it for this week. I hope you'll join us again in 2 weeks for the first full episode of the season 2 of Modified Rule. But that's it for now. So we'll see you soon.